This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to episode 104 of the Bulak Podcast. I'm Ursula Lindsay in Amman, Jordan, and with me as always is my friend and co-host, Marsha Links Quayle in Rabat, Morocco. Hi, Marsha.
Hi, Ursula.
And today we're going to be talking about putting together writing about and from Gaza. Marsha is just wrapping up an issue of the magazine that she has founded and edited, Arab Lit Quarterly, the literary anthology, and it is entirely dedicated, this new issue, to Gaza. And I want to hear about what it was like to put it together. So I have a lot of questions for you, Marsha, but I know that you wanted to start out by sharing some of the writing itself.
Yeah, I'm going to start out by reading from Hebat Lara's A Sour Memory, translated by Julia Chukervisoso, and this is just an excerpt from the piece. I arrange my migrating memory in my little drawers, into Tupperware in the kitchen, inside bottles of shampoo and detergent. How can I fold what remains of my life's details into my children's closet? And how do I collect them hurriedly into the getaway bag? How could I have left the coffee machine vulnerable to dust and noise? How could we have left the windows shut? The sour memory stings me. Days stretch out on hospital floors like martyrs, also meeting their end, departing with us into eternity. Days are our provisions in war. We fold them like socks, tucking them into each other so they don't get lost. We count them on our fingers. We see our wasted lives. Rushdie was martyred, like Raghid before him and Hamad before them. Death pulls them upward, even from under the rubble. Death opens its big mouth and doesn't shut it, swallowing up homes and everyone within.
Thank you for reading that. Yeah,
yeah, that's an excerpt by Hebat Lara, and this was written in the last 6 months. I don't have a date on this one, but many of the pieces we have a sort of a combination of things. There are many pieces by, I think, 21, 22 different writers that were written in these last 6 months. And then we also have classical pieces about Gaza, earlier depictions of Gaza, trying to give a portrait of the now, but also a space for writers to write about their lives now, to, you know, write really literature about now, not just, you know, what's going on, but also to look at the sort of wide picture of Gaza through time as well.
I think, we've talked about that on a previous episode, but how much one has the impetus to like assert the story that Gaza has told about itself over the years and over the decades, and the sort of history of that voice, that also sort of speaks to the hope of it, remaining and lasting. And we've talked about sort of like looking back at writers who have from Gaza have already written like famous, well-known texts, and one can draw from now. But then you decided, I'm not sure exactly when, that you were going to put together this issue that is all or has a lot of very recent, very contemporary writing.
Yeah, so that was actually the idea of So first we were going to put together an issue on Gaza, and I just began discussing it with a number of Palestinian writers and editors and translators that who I know. And Adania Shibli had the idea that we should do it as a co-production with Majalla 28 or Majalla 28 in Gaza, which is sort of the main literary magazine in Gaza. And so I reached out to Mahmoud and Mohammed, who are the two co-editors of the magazine, and they had already been wanting to put out an issue. However, it was simply sort of logistically impossible under the current circumstances. They had seen like a lot of beautiful writing. Really, I think I tried to give a flavor from Hebe's piece that this is not sort of literature of witness that is valuable because it's literature of witness. There are some incredible observations about sort of the nature of death and life and just, you know, beautiful observations about the universe. And they had wanted to assemble these, but just it simply, you know, now more recently, the search for food and water, but, you know, the search for safety and it's just simply in internet, it was not possible. So we decided we would work together, that we would do the logistical parts. Hassan is, of course, laying it out. As always, we're collating, translating, and assembling everything together. And they did the hardest work of going around Gaza and selecting, curating, finding these pieces. And then not only that, but, you know, sort of, you know, throughout the process, you know, going back to the writers, finding the writers again, asking them about, you know, preferred spellings and things like that, getting everybody's bio. I think it has been the logistically most challenging thing that I've ever done. And they're the most professional co-editors I've ever worked with. They, you know, they have their own magazine. They know how this works. And yet it's been extremely difficult because, you know, just on the basis of internet alone. But they were the ones who wanted to have this section that we're kind of internally calling this moment. Mm-hmm. Each of the pieces is kind of dated, and they're arranged chronologically of pieces written in October, November, December, January, and just sort of observing the world or anything that the writers wanted to write about. They've curated this selection of pieces. And then I was able to send it out to a group of translators and they're kind of jointly, anonymously translated by all of this collective of translators.
Oh.
The idea being that way the sort of the funds would go to all the writers in rather than the translators.
Right, because, well, an obvious way for people to support this project is, of course, to buy an issue, and they can at arablit.org. And then also multiple of the contributors to this issue have some fundraisers of their own, and we will also include that in the show notes. I think, struggle one with this moment that will not end incredibly unconscionably, like that just stretches out obscenely. And with this question of like what to do, how to show support, how to help people. And of course, a lot of that is going through like, you know, personal, you know, crowdfunding and things like that. But I think what you have done, what you and your collaborators and your contributors in Gaza have done is really exceptional and meaningful. And I mean, we've talked about there's been a big impetus to translate Palestinian writing more than ever and to disseminate it. But like you say, the actual logistical challenge of putting together a magazine partly from Gaza at this moment, because the people there want to, is pretty unique. Can you tell us a bit about what else we'll find in the issue?
Yeah, sure. So as you noted, so the magazine has been delayed a few times because really I want this to be the co-production of Majalla 28 and Arablit, and not to be just sort of us kind of taking something from them, but this to be a project that we're doing together. So we have to do it chronologically, the sort of the oldest things that we have, Selma Harland has written an essay called Naming Gaza, and I really learned so much from it. It's about how Gaza appears in sort of texts and artifacts from the time of the ancient Egyptians through, you know, the earliest Arabic sources. So how was Gaza described 3,500 years ago? And I think it kind of, you know, appears and reappears in poems and on coinage and in art and in inscriptions in clay tablets as this place, you know, of course it's a trading hub. It's a coastal city, and it was an important trading hub, but also as a place of generosity and refuge, as a place where people could run from other places and find a new home in Gaza. And I don't know, I found that very moving. Also as a center of wine production, apparently it was thousands of years ago. So this essay kind of brings together many classical sources from, you know, pre-Islamic sources to early Arabic texts. Mm. And then, you know, there's many sort of images that you can see of early coinage from the, you know, ancient Egyptian, from Roman, etc. Tom Abi Samra found us a 17th century travelogue that narrates a trip to Khan Yunis, and it describes a place of, I'll quote, happiness and bliss, a breeze at dawn blowing all the way from Jerusalem. That's sort of a little poetry snippet from the travelogue. So that he describes traveling there in the 17th century. And then we have also a classic piece that's not so long ago, an excerpt from Wayne Bezizo's Gaza Diaries from 1971 that we've titled Fighting with Matchsticks and Chalk. And I think this was something that Mohammed and Mahmoud felt very strongly about, and that's going to be the kind of the lead-in. That excerpt from this 1971 text is going to be the lead-in to the issue.
And Bezizo, of course, I mean, we've heard a lot about him. I've heard a lot about him in the last 6 months. I was not familiar with him before, but I think we even talked about his work on our last episode too. Famous playwright and from Gaza, and whose work has mostly not been translated into English yet, although right. He's very well known in Palestine, a famous leftist playwright and poet.
Yes.
So this is a text that hasn't appeared in English before?
Correct.
Okay, cool. Well, that's great. Are there a lot of new... Yeah, of course, there's a lot of new translations for this.
I think they're not all new translations because, for instance, Huda Fakhreddin, who translated the poem by Ibrahim Nasrallah and also by Samer Abu Hawesh, she felt the urgency of getting these out there in the world. So I think Samer's poem also appeared at Lit Hub and Ibrahim Nasrallah's at Mizna. Mm. And we didn't have any need for exclusivity on these works. So nearly everything is translated for the first time, but there are a couple of the poems that have also appeared elsewhere online. And most of the work also, we wanted to focus, or Mohammed and Mahmoud wanted to focus on writers who are alive. So we do have an excerpt of a poem by Salim al-Nafar, A Guitar Made of Ashes, who is a poet who died in the bombardment. But most of the work is by writers who are living there now.
Mm. And I think I have my first contribution to Arab Lit.
Yes,
in this.
Yes, true.
That's true. Which is not really about me, but and is another collaboration actually between Arab Lit and The Point, which is another magazine that I work with, and that was. Is an interview with the literary scholar Atif Ashar that I found very both illuminating and very moving, just in terms of how he frames the significance and the potential of writing and of literature in Gaza and in Palestine. And it's, you know, sort of both a, it's an overview of sort of the literary history and trends within Gaza, going all the way back to that antiquity that you talked about, but then to the sort of real explosion of resistance literature and nationalist literature from the 1960s onwards to today. Yeah, I found that really informative. And the way he frames it, which is so simple and so true, you know, he says, you know, people are writing, you know, as they're writing poems, like, you know, goodbye letters and self-elegies. And, you know, with the knowledge that they may not be there tomorrow, they are writing to, you know, put their souls into their words. And it's so devastating and so simply true.
Yeah, no, to that end, I want to read a poem by Batul Abu Aklin, which it will appear in this section that we're calling This Moment. And it was composed on February 26, 2024, and it very much goes to that point. I want a grave with a marble headstone that my loved ones will water, where they will place flowers, weeping when the longing lacerates their eyes. Their tears won't reach me, so I won't grieve. I want a grave just for me, for my friends to talk to me, where I'll have the right to be alone one last time. I want a grave that doesn't touch another, so my beloved can plant a bougainvillea to shade me from the summer sun, to dress me in a purple gown in spring, to give me a warm cover in winter when its leaves fall. I want a grave in a cemetery with neighbors who have wrapped themselves in life, flirted with it, planted a kiss on each of its cheeks, then slumbered. I want a grave. I don't want my corpse to rot in the open road. Oh. Yeah, so I found it to be, there were many pieces that were about the author's expectations of death or desires for death. And I found this very simple desire to have a grave and, you know, ideally a grave with neighbors who have wrapped themselves in life, flirted with it, planted a kiss on each of its cheeks, you know, to have a life where you just get a grave at the end. Oh, I found that image and the thought to be so, I don't have words. I don't have a sort of a critical apparatus for talking about these texts, but I found them to be very much texts that I wanted to share with other people.
Yeah. I think we found ourselves saying, I don't have words, so many times since October 7th, one is reduced to sort of speechlessness out of, you know, despair and indignation and, you know, discomfiture at the arguments, you know, in favor of continuing these massacres and this devastation. And, you know, so it is doubly, triply, tenfold to be admired to see people find the words.
Yes, there people find the words again and again, and not just the words, but the right words, the words full of clarity about the moment. And I think that this, you know, people, I don't know, university professors have often say that, you know, the writing is bad because the thinking is bad, right? And in this case, I think they see the situation very clearly and they can confront the situation, and this elevates the writing, I think. You know, I've seen some writing that is attempting to kind of justify genocide or you know, simply like whimpering about protests disrupting their morning coffee or whatever. And then in these instances, the writing is often also convoluted and the sentences are so turgid. I think, you know, the thinking is unclear, the unable to confront the situation, trying to hide from itself. But here the writing is not hiding. It's looking straight on. Yes, thank you. Thank you for putting together that conversation with Atif.
I mean, it was really my pleasure to have a chance to talk to him, and I'll put I mean, yeah, this is something that people can read in the issue. And then it's part of a series that we're hoping to continue, in which we'll be talking to Palestinian writers and scholars about particular aspects of Gaza. I mean, when we sort of struggled to find this title, and it's hard to find a good title, but preserving Gaza in the sense of preserving memory and history and knowledge, all of which is being, you know, purposely destroyed. And then, you know, sort of, and hoping that, you know, they will be preserved into the future and will persevere. So that's sort of the idea, is to sort of honor as much of all the intellectual and cultural and human life that has always been there, and to carry it forward, I think, in these conversations, which I think is, you know, the goal of a lot of the, I don't know, the writing and the literary work that one is seeing around Palestine right now, right?
Also, as I don't know, my feeling from talking to Mohammed and Mahmoud, also as a way of reaching out beyond where they are and connecting with readers out in the world, to feel their words traveling, if not their physical forms, you know,
right,
being able to go anywhere.
Right.
We also had a section of fiction, including by another Atif, a selection from Atif Abu Saif's 2019 novel, which Alice Guthrie finally has decided she wants to title Walk, Don't Walk, which is a kind of a literary mystery novel that begins when an old man is put in a coma during a hit and run. And the opening opening chapters, which we have in the issue, are really kind of a delightful kind of milieu novel of following everybody after this elderly man is hit and the car drives off, you know, everybody who goes to the hospital, everybody waiting in the hospital. It's a great kind of overview of this whole community you see coming together around this, you know, sort of, I don't know, much more innocent killing, or, you know, attempted murder. And, you know, Atif also has been in the news, I guess, recently. He's a novelist, a very award-winning novelist, and he's written a memoir, The Drone Sleeps With Me, I believe it's called, or The Drone Eats With Me, one or the other. The Drone Eats With Me, maybe. And he has also out a new memoir written in this period, out with Common Press, called Don't Look Left. And there was to be this launch event in Manchester. And then one organization started a rumor. Then they canceled the event. And it really took an enormous effort to get them to reverse that decision, which...
Oh, but they did in the end reverse it.
They did reverse the decision. They did.
What we're seeing across educational and publishing institutions is more than, you know, them having... I mean, there is sometimes like a very clearly, you know, ideological pro-Israeli line, but more often than not, it's just a path of least resistance, immediate... intellectual cowardice.
Yes.
You know, not wanting to even delve into a topic, get a proper grip on it, make up your own minds, you know, about the meaning of words, which is supposed to be your life, your vocation.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if we want to talk about, but I followed with some interest the utter fiasco over PEN America's literary awards, which have now been canceled. Is that right?
Yeah, well, you know, with so few people leaving themselves in the running for the award, yes, it was, they've decided
not to give
it out. So
many writers withdrew from the awards that they decided not to give it out this year.
Right. And the Jean Stein Award, the Jean Stein Foundation decided there was only one writer left in the running for that prize. And the writer's estate decided that they would donate it to Medical Aid for Palestinians or Palestinian Children's Fund. I'm not exactly sure.
I think it's the latter, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is because of the... the sort of widespread indignation over this organization that is not, you know, whose overt mission is not just to concern itself with literature, but to concern itself with freedom of expression and human rights, right? Their inability to like articulate anything other than, you know, mumbo jumbo position on what's happening in Gaza right now.
Ludicrous combination of, I think we've seen this from a number of large literary organizations such as Poetry Foundation, although I think PEN America in particular also is so tied in with the Democratic Party apparatus that they're kind of like moving in lockstep there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, absolutely this kind of very terrible wishy-washy combination of like, why can't we all get along, genocidaires and genocidees, plus this weird humble brag of, you know, plus our organization is really great and we're just, you know, small people. This is some of the writing that I do feel is so turgid and convoluted, and because they cannot confront what is going on or what they think or what are they committing to. So all of these statements are just nonsense loops.
I know, not even to the extent of sort of, you know, defending what's happening. Like, they don't want to do that either, right? Like, it's not even with the clarity of saying, like, you know, no, actually, we refuse to condemn this. Like, it's just a refusal to say anything, which I find a real abdication of, you know, your intellectual responsibility, and to hide behind, like, you know, we are all for nuance and articulation and like, you know, not, you know, and to, but to hide behind that as your reason for in effect saying nothing. Yeah.
They also had this bizarre claim that writers who turned down these awards and said they didn't want to go to this ceremony were silencing themselves.
Right. Okay. Are sort of turning down dialogue. Right. I mean, there is a point at which, you know, there's a certain kind of endless talking that becomes, you know, the equivalent of silencing. I don't know. It's going to be hard for me to articulate this right now, but, you know, it's really maddening to follow the way in which so many things are being spoken about right now. But I think that's a whole other discussion, perhaps.
I'm sorry. There's just one other piece from the magazine that I wanted to highlight, if we have just 1 second, which is...
Oh, please.
It's from a graphic novel that's not out yet in Arabic, but will be published in Arabic soon, by Huda Shewa and Michael Jabarin, called Gilgamesh's Skull, and it's coming out from Tamit Institute. And it's very contemporary, obviously, but it's the story of early 20th century archaeology and colonialism in Gaza. So it's a different angle on Gaza of, you know, the story of English colonizers, archaeology, and, you know, what they're digging up and how they're doing it. So this issue is very broad, both in terms of time and in terms of the different kinds of works, I mean, graphic novel, fiction, nonfiction, interview, poetry, etc.
Well, it sounds absolutely lovely. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah. Long awaited, but it will be coming very soon.
Well, I mean, worth the wait. And sometimes things take the time that they take. Mm-hmm. I think we also wanted to mention the passing away of the Palestinian writer Walid Daqa, who died in prison a few weeks ago while he was serving his 38th year in prison, I think. And there's you've read a young adult,
a YA novel, book, yeah,
that
yeah.
he wrote. So,
right. So that's how I got to know him, was my kind of obsession with young adult literature in Arabic. His YA novel, The Oil Secret Tale, won the Et Salat Prize for Arabic Children's Literature a few years ago. And it kind of echoes his own story, which is he conceived a daughter with sperm smuggled out of prison, for which he was, you know, punished with solitary confinement. And in this novel, which is kind of a magical realist or simply magical telling, there's a 12-year-old boy named Jude, also conceived with his father's imprisoned father's sperm. And in this instance,
I just think this is sorry, I just need to break it there to say it because it's so incredibly weird, because he was denied all conjugal visits
with his wife. Yeah.
I mean, because the first time I heard this, I just sort of couldn't put two and two together. Like, I found it so shocking that this was necessary. But please go ahead. So he based this story on his own experience,
right? In part, but Jude is he discovers a magical olive tree which gives him an oil that helps turn him invisible. And then he is able to sneak into the prison and meet his father, which clearly is a kind of, you know, wish fulfillment in a way. I found it, he's also written other works, a memoir, but I find it, this is a different kind of prison writing, I think, of prisoners who are serving life sentences in Israeli prisons. Prisoners who, they're not going in and out, observing life inside and outside, but their horizons have been closed down entirely to the prison. And so there are a couple other, there's another memoir. Sorry, go ahead.
I just wanted to add a few things about Dhaka himself before we move on. So he was condemned because he was held responsible for the murder of an Israeli soldier. Even though he did not participate in the killing, he was charged with being the leader of the group that carried it out, which is something that he always denied. So just for what crime got him in prison for life to begin with, a very problematic trial with very little evidence in which he was held responsible for killing that he was definitely did not actually carry out, but he was sort of, and then he was given this life sentence, and then he was allowed to marry, but he was never allowed any visits with his wife, and which is why he conceived his daughter this way. And he also was ill with cancer at the end of his life. He was not allowed proper medical treatment. He was not allowed to leave and die in the presence of his wife or his child. Mm. His body at first was not even released to his family, and his family's funeral service that they tried to host at their house was broken into and dispersed by the Israeli police. So a life sentence is terrible enough, but when you actually know the sort of details of the life sentences of Palestinian political prisoners, they are denied the basic rights of, you know, including to healthcare. His sentence was also extended by a couple years, right when he was supposed to be let out.
Yeah, he was supposed to be let out, but he'd helped supposedly helped smuggling some phones.
He helped some other prisoners get a cell phone, and so he was given two more years. So I mean, like, and his family not being allowed to even like grieve with him and see him. So what you're talking about, it's these life sentences which are just also carried out without even some of the like basic rights and reprieves that a prisoner can expect. So yeah, to come to terms with that, to live in these conditions to write about them is an extraordinary sort of situation to be in as a human being. And I honestly don't know how people manage.
Right. And many of them, so there's three books that I'm just going to briefly mention, and all of them, you know, imprisoned very young in their early 20s with life sentences, and had to educate themselves inside prison. So their entire lives basically are taking place inside prison. And as you said, it's punitive not only toward them, but also towards all of their loved ones. You know, mourning tent raided, mourners beaten, your funeral service dispersed. So this other one, which is coming out now in translation, The Tale of a Wall by Nasr Abu Surur, also has the second half is a kind of a love story of him wanting to fall in love with this woman who manages to visit him in prison, wanting to form a relationship as sort of an ordinary thing in a life. But I mean, I guess, you know, you can leave it to people to read it, but obviously it's not possible to have, but this incredible desire to be able to have an ordinary love in a life that's entirely inside iron and concrete, as he says. And then the third is Besim Khandakshi's A Mask, The Color of the Sky, which is a novel, not a memoir, but shortlisted for this year's International Prize for Arabic Fiction. And by the time this episode airs, we'll know whether or not it's won or not. But he was born in Nablus, and he wrote short stories until he was imprisoned in 2004 at the age of 21. And he had to do his university degree in prison, but has since published both poetry collections and novels, even though when he was shortlisted for the IPAF, I think the Jerusalem Post went and asked Israeli prison services, who said, "We do not recognize this book. Distribution of writings from inside prison walls is a crime if he is decided." Yeah. So actually writing these, his brother gave an interview saying that he mostly writes between 5 a.m. and 6:30 or something horrible like that. And that he writes with the expectation that anything might be seized. So if you imagine him with a memoir, it might be one thing, but with trying to construct a novel with bits and pieces of it get out to his brother, who is then trying to assemble it, and bits and pieces of it gets taken away, and he has to try again and again to craft it. But he's gotten this out. It was published, and it's up for this big award. So, yeah, and his brother also said, you know, he's been transferred several times from one prison to another, and prison guards taking his writings whenever they find it. So he's also there on, I think, 3 consecutive life sentences. Again, I believe he's thought to have been involved with a group that orchestrated a killing, but he himself did not participate in.
Right. And I mean, you know, the laws under which people's culpability and their connection to terrorist groups and acts are established in Israeli courts, I think, are have come in for quite a lot of criticism. Including the way in which all confessions and information is obtained. I mean, unfortunately, another significant addition to what is one of the primary genres of literature, you know, in Arabic, which is prison literature. I mean, practically, you know, every country in the region has famous examples of it. And unfortunately, there's quite a few. I mean, just many, many entries in Palestine. I don't know what else to say about this.
Yeah, I it's interesting because, of course, the United States imprisons a very large percentage of its population, and yet prison literature is not the same. It does not have a similar status in English. Hmm. I think prisoners, of course, in this case, right, the prisoners maintain a sort of a status in the community, an access to publishing houses that I would imagine, you know, not really understanding how the U.S. publishing system works, but that prisoners in the United States don't have.
Well, also, I mean, a lot of the a lot of famous prison, I mean, not all, but like a lot of people who were already famous writers were then thrown in prison.
Right.
So
right.
It's almost, I mean, it's almost a rite of passage. And then of course there's the other sort of experience, which is someone who is, does not come from a literary or even a particularly educated background and who becomes a writer basically, in prison. And, you know,
right. Like Mohammed Shoukry, for instance.
Like Mohammed Shoukry, like the author of the other of Tazmamart, cell number 10, the other very famous Moroccan prison memoir, and I'm apologies blanking on his name right now. Yeah, I mean, yes, there's these two avenues, but then maybe you're right. It is interesting because it's so recognized as I mean, as a genre, as an
experience. A respectable genre.
Right, right. Absolutely. What could be more respectable than to go to jail? Absolutely. Well, I just want to remind people again that they can find the new issue of Arab Lit Quarterly on the website, arablit.org. That we will also put some links to fundraisers that are ongoing. I know there's so many and everybody is, you know, doing everything they can, but we, you know, we have a few more to share of people we know or that you have worked with. A reminder to please subscribe to the show, share the show, rate the podcast if you would like to. And then I just wanted to say, I'm following the protests at American universities that have been taking place in the last days. We're recording on April 25th, including at a couple universities that I've attended. And I think we have some listeners who are students and professors. And, you know, thank you for doing this. You have nothing but my admiration and support. And it's one of the few things that has been a source of hope in the past week has been to see the level of mobilization. So good job.
Yeah, thanks to everyone and goodbye for this time.
Yeah, nice talking to you, Marsha. Bye.
Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.